I'm Anita Annabelle, and this is The Good Chat.
No, I'm not like compliments.
I'm quietly, I'm loving it.
I love making friends. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm a psychic. This podcast is going to be a
little chit chat.
This is probably the best chat. No, that's why this is called The Good Chat. We get good chat, mate.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Good Chat. I am your host, Anita Annabelle. In this episode of The Good Chat, I chat to Mark Billy Billingham from SAS Australia. In truly one of the best chats of this series, I talk to Billy about how stealing a hat from an old man led him to a life in the army and put him on the straight and narrow. We also chat about how he built a school with actor Sean Penn in Haiti, and what being a bodyguard for some of the world's most high-profile celebrities involve. He's a humanitarian, motivational speaker, and DS of SAS, and life is infinitely better with him in it. Now, we recorded this episode way back in March when Billy arrived in Australia and was quarantining before filming. However, the story truly checks out and doesn't age a day. Billy taught me all about the University of Life, and I hope that you get as much out of this chat as I did. Here's Mark Billy Billingham.
Hello, I'm so thrilled to have you on my podcast because I adore you. And the last time we had a chat, it was so much fun and you are such a great storyteller. So I had to have you have a chat with me again.
It's an absolute pleasure to be able to speak to you. And hopefully I'll keep you entertained.
Oh, you always keep me entertained. And you're sitting currently, we're actually recording this in March and you are currently sitting in quarantine, which has not been an easy feat for you since you love to be in the outdoors. What have you been doing to keep yourself busy?
I'm doing between 4 and 5 physical training, 40-minute physical training sessions a day in a confined space. So my cardio will be amazing, but I probably won't be able to walk up there.
You probably don't like to sit still and watch TV, do you?
I'm not a person to be locked down, to be honest. So I'm almost like the bear in the zoo. I'm walking back and forth. And we're overlooking what looks like an office complex, and the people can see right into my room, so they must be thinking, that's going crazy.
They must be having such a show, honestly.
Oh, I hope there's no paparazzi in there, otherwise I'm in trouble.
I wonder if they recognise you.
I don't know. I don't think so. No, I mean, we've actually got a balcony, but it's enclosed, so we're not actually out in the sort of open, if you know what I mean. That makes sense.
And so what about the other guys? Are they all in the same hotel with you?
We're all together but apart. So I'm on one floor, directly above me is Ollie, directly above that is Anne, directly above that is Foxy.
How did Foxy get so high?
He's the big bear, isn't he? So we'll put him at the top of the tree.
Well, I'm thrilled that you're going to be coming out of quarantine soon because you're going to be doing SAS Australia again, which I love, everybody in Australia loves. But I'm actually more interested in you as a person because your story is so fascinating and I think that a lot of people really need to hear it. But if it's okay with you, I think the best place to start is at the beginning because your childhood really shaped who you are today. So can you explain to everybody what it was like growing up in the West Midlands in England?
Yeah, I was born in 65, so early 70s, you know, I was a toddler growing up into sort of early, mid 70s. I'm born into a poor family, you know. I had an elder brother, elder sister, younger brother, younger sister. I was the middle child. And anybody who has a middle child or anyone who is a middle child, you know, we're not quite wired the same. I was a little bit wild right from the word go, you know. And mom and dad worked 12-hour shifts. So, you know, one was in, one was out. We were, you know, off to school and stuff. And around the area at the time was a lot of gangs, you know, young gangs. And there was a lot of trouble going on and all this sort of stuff and people getting in trouble. And I gravitated towards that. I straight away from the age of 9. I was sort of in little gangs and doing bad things, which I'll talk more about when I do my tour. But I ended up, you know, stealing, fighting all the time, getting in trouble. And the thing about it is, I think even at that age of 9, I knew what I was doing. I knew I was causing trouble. But I was kind of manipulating my mom and dad because kids do. Yeah. But I knew it, you know. And you know, when you hear the saying, people go, "Oh, he got in with the wrong crowd." Well, actually, I was the wrong crowd. I was leading other kids astray and being bad. And at the age of 11, I ended up in court, you know, in juvenile court at the age of 11. And, you know, I was in court for ABH, GBH, trespass, all sorts of stuff.
What does that mean? What's and ABH? Is that a apprehended violence order?
No, actual bodily harm, fighting.
Oh, sorry, basically. Actual bodily harm, ABH. Oh, my goodness.
I was getting in a lot of trouble, but I mean, it's really started when I was 9. I was, you know, we had a little gang and we were stealing off old men. We used to steal hats. And then one particular day, this old guy chased me and caught me, which I never expected, a 17-year-old man to catch a 9-year-old. I was like a little whippet. And he caught me. Rather than giving me a good hiding, he said, "Look," I stole his hat basically. And he said, "Look, keep the hat, you little shit." That's what he called me. And he said, "Come to my boxing gym." And I was like, of course. I mean, I was petrified. So I threw the hat at him and said, "Yeah, of course I will." And he told me where the gym was. And it was in a bar downtown in Walsall. And I was 9 years old. So I ended up going. For some strange reason, someone said to me, "Go to this boxing gym." And I went. And I didn't know what to expect. I was 9 years old. I was in the middle of February. It was dark. Snow on the ground. I'm about 4 miles from my home, on my own, meeting an old man behind the back of a bar. Can you imagine that today? But anyway... And the reason I talk about this is because this was probably the second most influential person in my life outside of my father, although my father couldn't control me. And so I went to this gym and I went inside petrified. I didn't know what to expect. And there was a bunch of kids my age and all the street naughty kids basically around my area. And he started teaching us boxing. And I never forget it to this day. And this is very, very true. He took me to one side and he said, "Like, listen, boxing's not about brutality. Boxing is a poor man's game of chess." And I'm looking at him, he said, "It's about anticipation. It's about thinking. It's about being one step ahead, always ready to maneuver, always about to go that little bit further, you know?" And that word, always a little bit further, is very, very true. 20-something years later, when I joined the SAS, is part of not our motto, but our prayer.
Yeah.
Always a little further. It's my mantra. So I always remember this old guy, and he kind of kept me on the straight and narrow for a while. But then I started going a little bit rogue again. And a bit later on, I joined the cadets after my elder brother said, "Look, there's a cadets thing." And I said, "What's that about?" He says, "It's like a military school thing." I said, "I'll try that." So I went and I met the next sort of influential guy who was amazing. But he was a no bullshit person. You know, even though you were a kid, he treated you like an adult. He goes, "You will do this, you will do that." And I kind of gravitated to the discipline. I liked it. You know, I was like, wow, I like this. And then my schooling really went out the window, although I wasn't doing particularly well anyway. I wasn't turning off half the time at the age of 11, 12 anyway. And what the thing with me was, I was thinking, well, in the cadets, I was being taught how to navigate, how to save life doing first aid, how to do signals and communications. In school, I was learning arithmetic and English. And I thought, well, where does that fit into my life? I don't get this.
Yeah.
So really suffered, and I kind of thought, this is where I need to be. And then at the age of 13, I basically got suspended from school but never really went back. After thinking I was really big and hard and clever, I glued the maths teacher to the chair and it didn't go down too well.
Oh,
so I ended up getting kicked out of school, and I never really went back, if I'm honest. I only used to go back once or twice, once maybe twice a week, because I was the captain of the football B team and I had to be there on this particular day. And then on the Friday to be picked for the A team, I had to go on Friday. So they were the only days I'd go, if I went at all. And this went on and on.
I can't believe you glued. Looking at you, I'm like, yeah, no, that's something that you would absolutely do.
Well, I mean, even if I remember rightly, back in the early 70s when I did this, Mr. Lynch was his name, and he had tweed trousers. And these tweed trousers, as he reminded me, cost him £30 as I dived out the window and ran away. Mr. Lynch, if you're still out there, I owe you a pair of tweed trousers.
Poor Mr. Lynch. I have a feeling Mr. Lynch might not be alive anymore, which is really sad. But I'm actually really fascinated by the first man that you were talking about, the one that took you to the boxing ring. Like, that is like something out of a movie. That is insanity. And what was his name?
You know what? I think it was Robert Mitchum, believe it or not, like the film star.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. It was either Robert or Tom Mitchum. He was a big old boy, 6 foot something, like Herman Munster, but hands like, you know, big, like a big bear. He was just an amazing guy. Really nice. And I didn't know what to expect. I was expecting a good hiding. Why the hell have I went there? I don't know. But someone told me to go. And as I walked in, I'm walking in behind him. I'm pooping myself. And I'm thinking, what's he going to do? We go through it because it was in the back of a pub. It wasn't a proper boxing gym. It was illegal. And we went in. And I'm like looking and I'm thinking, what's going to happen now? And my heart was coming through my mouth. But I still went.
Yeah.
And as he opens, there's five or six other kids. And I recognize one or two from another gang, all training, doing. And I thought, I'll calm down a bit, you know? And this guy, sorry, I'm going to jump forward a little bit here. So when I wrote my book, this old guy here, it was a guy who gave me a chance who really shouldn't have done, if you know what I mean.
Well,
I've gone through my crazy ass life and I'm now at the end of my, not the end of my life, I didn't mean that, but I'm now that old man now. I'm the one that's giving back. Because I'm the one, I want to work with rogue kids. I want to work with bad teenagers because no one else wants to. And these are our family. And he obviously knew that. So, again, after that old guy there, I always gravitated towards older people as well because it can be the history of life. And as much as they give you the information, which I'd use, I still got in trouble, you know, because you do. It's like if, you know, you say to your kid, don't touch that because it's hot. What do?
You touch it.
You touch it. So, you know, he was an amazing person in my life. And there's two or three of them that I talk about as I go through. And the reason I talk about all this, and it might sound light humor, but it's to say to people, you know, this is not the right thing to do. Although I thought at the time it was, and I haven't done too bad at the end of it.
No.
It was not good to go, and a lot of lessons learned. And, you know, and what is weird or funny, if I like, is I'm at that age now where, you know, most of my sort of aunties, uncles, they're passing away. So we don't go to so many weddings anymore. It's more funerals. And every time I go, by the way, I'm 55 years old, and I'll go to a funeral and they'll go, my aunties that are still alive go, oh, you put the grey in your mum's hair. And I'm like, come on, auntie. I was 9 years old. I'm 50. Give me a break.
That is, you're a legend. You're a legend back home, basically.
I'm the one who put all the grey hair in my mum's hair.
Your poor mum. But so at 11 years old, you were stabbed. Is that correct?
I was 15.
You were 15 when you were stabbed. Okay, so at 15 years old, you were stabbed. How did that happen? How did you get yourself into that situation?
It was a little bit of gang warfare, local gang warfare. And as you got older, it got more violent. You know, you ended up hurting people and people. I never did any of that. I ended up in a fight with these couple of guys. And long story short, while I was sort of, it was on a railway embankment. And while I was fighting with someone inside of a railway embankment, the other guy came behind me and stuck the knife in my back. And as the knife went straight into the small of my back, the other guy pulled my feet. So he went, as I sort of went out, and he went all the way up my back and basically left me for dead, really. And I crawled back to the house. It was only a couple of 100 meters from my house because we lived on a railway embankment. And I crawled back bleeding. And I remember as I was crawling back, it was that, like when you get kicked between the legs, that feeling of couldn't get my breath. And I was crawling. But then after the part, almost getting home, because I was losing a lot of blood, I was kind of lightheaded. And it was kind of a nice, weird feeling.
That is
I remember as I got into the house, you know, I was covered in blood and mum was panicking and all this sort of stuff and ended up rushing me off to hospital. But I think between that sort of pain and nice feeling, I realised I've got to get out of this. I've got to stop this. I'm going to die. I'm not going to survive if I stay here anymore. And it was, you know, during that period, I guess, of recovery, somewhere around that time where I really knew I had to get away, get into the army or the military or something disciplined to give myself a chance of survival. And the weird thing about all that is my brothers and my sisters weren't never in any trouble. It was only me. You know, my dad used to call me Mad Jack.
I just feel like that was you were meant to do that, though. That seems like that was your path because now look at you. I mean, I don't think your brothers and your sisters are doing what you're doing. So it was really meant to be what your path is, and I think that's quite incredible. But also then, so after being stabbed and realising that you needed to get out, when were you at cadets at this stage and then did you end up going, and you were, and then that was when you decided to go in the army?
Yeah, I was always gravitating towards the military, as I said, and my schooling had already gone by the wayside. And at the age of 15, not long after I'd been stabbed, I got a job. I was working nights in a factory, illegal, totally illegal.
Yeah.
I was working 12-hour shifts in a factory, earning £80 back in the 80s. And it was at the time I'd applied then to join the army. I was still doing cadets, and I'd applied to join the army. And I was going to join as a junior leader, which meant I could go in at the age of 16. Mm. And my criminal record from when I was 11 was just about finished, because it was only held for 5 years or whatever it was. So I was just going to make it, was, you know, it was a clearance for me to do, start a new fresh life. And while I was working in the factory one night, I ended up having an accident, and basically I almost died, you know. And
again,
long story short, I slipped into caustic soda and into a vat. The vat was like 6 foot deep, but I only fell into just below my ankles because of the pain. Somehow, I don't know to this day how, but I ended up doing like a backflip out of it in the pain. Someone grabbed me, ran me to the taps, turned the taps on, and all the skin fell off my legs, basically. Yeah, they took me to hospital, and I had to lie then while I was in hospital and say I broke into the factory, because obviously
they wouldn't be liable.
Jobs that had closed the factory down, all this sort of stuff. So that's what I did. They didn't follow it up with the police or any criminal record, which was a good thing for me. But what it did do is I then had like 6-7 months of recovery while my sort of skin reeled and my feet, it reeled and I couldn't track. So I missed joining as a junior, 16, and I went in a bit later on, and then eventually got into the military.
That recovery period, I feel like there's so many instances in your life that things have happened that have literally gone, have made you what you were, you know, it put you on that path. So I feel like, you know, you had that recovery period. Imagine if you'd gone in at 16, I wonder what would have happened. Like, I wonder if you would have gone into service and died. Isn't that, like, it's a sliding doors thing.
Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, I'm probably like yourself. Things happen for a reason, and things happen because they're meant to happen. I've been in so many situations where, you know, I think about it and I go, how the hell? Why am I still here? How did I get out of that? Because I should have done. I was meant to. You know, and it was the right move at the right time, or the wrong move at the wrong time, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, I've never, you know, all the stuff that I've done, I've never had that feeling that I'm not coming out of this. But when we've come out of it, you know, people, even today when I have a beer with people, go, how the hell are you still alive? And they'll talk about a situation. They go, do you remember? And of course I remember it. And you're like, how the hell are you still here? And that happens to a lot of people, not just me, but I'm talking about my personal time, my personal experience. Yeah,
you've had a lot of near-death experiences. In fact, that was actually one of my questions when we talk about the Army and the SAS. Like, I was actually like, oh, do you have any moments that you nearly lost your life? Like, and not even thinking that it would, most of them would happen before you even joined.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a sort of a checkered life up to joining the army, you know, lucky escape, if I'm honest.
Such a lucky escape. You know? And so then in the army, where did you, so I know that you ended up in the SAS, but in the army, what did you do in the army to then make you go, I'm going to then join the SAS?
So I joined the parachute regiment initially, which is an elite unit anyway. They're awesome. Absolutely fantastic. And, I did 9 years in the parachute regiment. You know, as a young, from a young kid, I grew, went through all the training, went on operations, did all this sort of stuff, got a lot of experience. And then it's a bit like if you were a soccer player and, you know, you start off in a good team, but you want to be in the best team. Mm. The best team is the best in the terms of soldier around the world. And I'll stand on any stage and I'll tell you, the British SAS are, without a shadow of a doubt, the best soldiers in the world. Mm. We do the best stuff. Best, you know, alongside we work with Australia on all our SAS, but it's the elite, it really is. And anyway, so after my time of being in the parachute regiment, a lot of friends had already gone off to the SAS, and I knew they were doing great stuff. I didn't know exactly what they do because you don't talk a lot about it, but I knew it was good, and I just felt I've got to do it for two reasons. One, I'd love to be working at the level that they're working at and the operation tempo they were working at, and two, I just want to know if I can do it, because so many people fail, of course. So few that get through it. And an example, I think there's 283 on my course and 7 got through it.
Wow.
You know, so that's the numbers you're looking at. So I just wanted to know, could I be one of those people to get through SAS selection? So, yeah, and so that was another reason why I did it. And actually, that number 7 is a very lucky number for me, because when I joined the parachute regiment, I'd just gone 17. I was the youngest and the skinniest. I was 70. And again, 7 of us originals passed. So
that is so cool. 7 is your lucky number for sure. And it's obviously kept you alive. I still can't get over the amount of times that you've nearly died. And so in terms of the army, I mean, you traveled everywhere, and in the SAS as well, you traveled absolutely everywhere. But was there actually any, like, there obviously were moments where you almost did lose your life while you were in the army?
Yeah. I mean, there's many times, you know, you've been close to being blown up, you've been shot at regularly, the training exercises accidents when you're building up to go into operations and war, because you train real. You know, I've been in some bad car crashes and stuff like that. I've been blown up, I've been shot at. Yeah, there's you know, you got to remember the sort of level that the Special Forces work at. You work at strategic level, which means what you do has a massive impact on the whole of your country, not just on a small bit, or even on the world. You know, it changes policies and direction of world policy and life-saving stuff that you do. It's crazy. But in order to achieve that sort of stuff, there's a lot of risk, a lot of risk. And, you know, there's many people that didn't come back from it.
How do you... The only way I can put this is, how on earth do you sleep at night? I don't... The trauma that you have seen, the things that you have been a part of, I just don't understand how you can close your eyes without having nightmares.
So I'll be honest with you, I mean, I have never actually, you know, I haven't suffered. I've been fortunate not to suffer with mental illness or PTSD. A lot of people do. And, you know, we're all, which shows you every human being is different. You know, maybe somewhere down the line, something's all going to catch me up and kick me straight in the face when I'm not expecting it. But no, I mean, the only time I've had dark moments, don't get me wrong, you know, when people die and this, that, the other, and funerals and whatever else, and you blame, you feel guilty and this, whatever. We've had all that, but I don't suffer a lot from it, or don't really suffer from it. The only time I've ever really felt if I've had anything close to PTSD or traumatized is when my mom and dad died, not when all the stuff. I think because I was prepared for probably not coming back, and all the stuff that I was doing, you know, I was enjoying what I was doing. I was being paid for what I was doing. I knew it was dangerous. So I was kind of half prepared for it. Mm. But when mom and dad died, which was only 3 weeks apart, that really, and then I realized, wow, I am never going to be able to go and have a word with my mom or my dad ever again. And my friends, I kind of accepted it. Although, you know, you have people die around you and it's horrendous. It's sad. And it becomes even more sad when you stood at the grave watching them being put down into the grave and the wife and their kids that you know stood there. That gets to you. But you go, okay, we did what we did. We knew we were going to do that. Let's go. But when my mom and dad died, I mean, my mom was dying of cancer, so I knew she was dying. Mm. She was died over 2 years. She was harder than a coffin nail. And it actually became a bit of a joke with me. I used to come home and say, "Are you still alive?" And she'd start laughing. And go, "Oh, you terrible you are." And we'd have a laugh about it. My dad was a big old boy. He's like 6'3" or 6'4". And one night I was away and I got a phone call in the middle of the night. And it was my hysterical sister. And I just thought, I knew. Mom's died. And that's what I was expecting. And then she didn't. She says, "Dad's died." And I was like, "Say that again." My dad died before my mom. And that was just, that really threw me.
How did he pass? From a heart attack or?
Cancer. He had cancer and he kept it to himself. He would not, didn't share it. Yeah. It was bizarre. And I think because he knew mom was dying, you know, I say he died from a broken heart because he knew mom was going to die. And he didn't want to be left. I know a lot. They're like Tom and Jerry. They were so funny together. You know, they used to laugh. They'd be sort of putting each other down. They loved each other to death. It was hilarious. But yeah, so that's back to the question. That's where I had dark times over that period, because I couldn't get my head around it. So then I buried my dad. I did the eulogy for my dad. And you know, and that period of time, I thought about what was my dad really like. And for the years growing up, I kind of was a bit harsh with him because I thought he was never there. He was this, he was that, blah, blah, because he was working all the time. And I realized actually how good a dad he really was. And then he went, so I did the eulogy. That was hard. And then I flew back to America and I was only there for 3 weeks. I get another phone call, and then mum died literally 3 weeks later. So it was a traumatic, dark, horrible time, you know. So then I didn't suffer, but it knocked me about a bit. And I had a few sleepless nights. It was weird. But no, when you say, how do you sleep? Actually, I don't think I've slept much in the last 7 days being in here. Nothing to do with that.
Yeah. No, you've got me all emotional. That is such a sad story. Oh my goodness, poor thing. And it's just I can feel that there's probably so many people listening that can feel that pain and to feel, you know, the loss of a parent or the loss of a loved one. My sister was so sick with leukemia a couple of years ago, and we almost thought we'd lose her, and like that was so traumatic. And she's actually you'd be so proud of her. Actually, she ran 5 marathons for 5 years of being cancer free, so which was amazing. I can't even fathom not having her and not having both my parents. So I can't even imagine what you're going through. It's totally heartbreaking. Yeah.
But here's the thing, what you just said there, you know, like your sister having leukemia and all that sort of stuff, and then she's running marathons and doing this. But I'll tell you what, that almost losing your life makes you realise how valuable life is.
Yeah.
And you can actually do amazing things.
Yeah.
And you realise, you don't start taking life for granted anymore. You start living it and doing it and realising, listen, there will be dark times, but you'll get through it. It's a passage in time. Just enjoy what you've got. Enjoy the love of the family and the people around you. Forget all the negativity. Forget all the assholes around you. Just drop all that and just move forward. And I mean, what your sister's done there is just amazing. And I love life. I'm still trying to push myself over the limits all the time, you know, doing wacky, crazy stuff. But
like working out 4 times a day, which is wild to me.
I wouldn't be doing that normally. If the bar was open and I was out, that's where I'd be.
That's true. That's so true.
I'm like the one taking a day, and then the rest will be in the bloody pub.
Like a night, good old Brit. That's exactly what you would do. Actually, you were so motivating. I really the first time you and I spoke, and I've interviewed you before for my job, but the first time you and I spoke, I remember getting off the phone and like going back to the girls and just being like, that was so, Billy is the incredible, because you are so motivating and you're so matter of fact, and you actually made me feel like, I don't know, it was just this incredible, it was so amazing to speak to you. And I'm not just saying that because you're talking to me right now. It was just this, the way that you speak, the way it is about living life to the fullest, and it's the way that you motivate others. When you speak to people, do you outwardly go out and go, I just really want to motivate that person to live a better life?
Well, I'll tell you what I do, and this is not being derogative to anybody. I'm not one of these people who throws all these quotes out and these statistics, you know, grab a bite of the earth and make it yours. I mean, what the hell does that mean? Come on. What a bullshit. I'll say what I believe in. I'll say what I believe is the truth, you know, and that's the thing that I keep saying today is we don't tell the truth anymore. We're all too scared, and we've become all insular and isolated, you know, and scared. We've lost this older sort of role models thing, you know. You're scared for a little, you know, if I'm walking down the street and a little kid comes running up to me, the first thing I'm going to do is look for his parents. I'm like that. I mean, you're like, do you know, but that's the world we're in now.
Yeah.
So I think my motivation is based on my life and my experience. Mm. You know, I've had such a long, you know, up and down type of life. I've done most things, not everything, of course. And I'm very honest about, if I don't know the answer, I'll say I don't know. And it's just about being honest and giving examples of where you can see what people are doing wrong. And you go, you know, listen, I've been there, I've done it. And that's what old people used to say. You know, so that's why, again, talking with either, I'm talking, when I say old people, I'm talking 70s, 80-year-old. That's what I used to always spend time chatting to, because they've been through the life of relationships, finance, trouble, you know, all, they've been through it all. Mm. And lessons learned. And we're all doing the same sort of, make the same mistakes. So I always, I give that knowledge that I have of what I think and what I've done. And I think it just helps a lot of people.
I think what's most inspiring about you is that you just live your truth about who you are. And I think when you say that people are scared, it's so true. I think people are scared to outwardly say something, But people also are very scared to live their truth and live who they really are.
I think we all have to have a filter. You know, we've all got opinions and our views about whatever it might be, whether it's racism, whether it's political agenda, whether, you know, you've just got to be sensible about how you come across about that and ranting and raving. You know, I don't hold back. If I'm really passionate about something, I'll say it. And I'll back it and I'll stick with it.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, nobody really going to persuade me otherwise. But I'm not one of these people who just rants and raves and comes out with nonsense for the sake of it, just to be heard.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you also have to be careful having a platform as well. You know, people that you know have said things and have, you know, it's really affected their careers. And I think that it's so important, even while living your truth, that you're still not coming out and, you know, offending a whole lot of people or...
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm one of the biggest things I think I've learned going through my life is life's about giving. It's about giving back. You know, we've all got, and there's such a great pleasure in giving something back to somebody, to put a smile on somebody else's face. It's just, you know, money don't frigging give you that joy. I mean, you can, you know, we do need money, we need finance, we need to be able to survive, but people get obsessed with this name and this looking, being on this pedestal and earning this money. It's not, it's about... I love my platform because my platform now, people help. When I run a charity in Haiti, look, putting kids through school and stuff. And since I've got to, people listen and they help and they get involved and it's amazing. And I think everybody, it doesn't matter whether you're on a platform or not on a platform, we can all help and give back and do the decent thing, like, you know.
You're about to film SAS Australia with celebrities at the time of recording. And then later on this year, you're filming with Aussies from all walks of life. What do you want to help them achieve?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's to tell them who they really are. Because they don't know who they really are. And when it's what we do with everybody. We strip everybody back to who the real core. Because we've all got little fronts. There's all things we don't want to talk about. There's all things we don't want to... you know, embarrass ourselves by trying and going that little, as I always say, going that little bit further and going out of the comfort zone. So that's what we do. We'll put them out of the comfort zone, not to belittle them or to make them look foolish, but to strip them back to who they really are. And we'll tell them, you know, based on experience, based on what you can see. I can see through people. I can read people and give them, within a couple of days, you really get the measure of how people think that, what people think they are and what they really are. And then, and telling them directly what you are, not being derogatory, but saying, you know, you need to do this, you ain't doing this, you're playing this game, you need to. And people, they haven't been spoken like that by anybody before. And they're, oh. And that's, and then again, that's based on, I mean, I've had so much experience through the military, so much experience around the world, different people, different cultures, and there's just so many things that, you know, based on all what we've done and seen, that we have to offer to everybody on how they act, how they perform, and what could make them better. The ultimate thing is to make them better, make them see a better person. You know, I can't do that. Yes, you can do it. You can do it, and you're going to do it. And all right, they didn't get to exactly where that point they wanted to be, but they're still a better person because they've gone that little bit further than they thought. And it's just getting that out of people, you know. It's easy to say no, and I can't. Take away that can't, because you can. You can't do everything that's true, but you can do better. And we get that out of you, everybody.
I need you to, like, every day just tell me that in the morning. I need to put that as my alarm. I need to put Billy as my alarm.
Yeah, always above your head, always a little further, because you can go always a little further. If you move forward 2 inches, it's 2 inches. Yeah. It's 2 inches than you were before in terms of getting better and doing better.
With the SAS, I'm really curious, for both the TV show and being in the SAS, what is the most common question that people ask you that you can't believe that people ask you?
It's the worst question that anybody can ask anybody. It's, how many people have you killed? It's the most ridiculous question.
People ask you that?
They honestly, they do. And you're just like, I just always come straight back with, how many people have I saved? Did you ask me? Honestly, it's just ridiculous. People ask it crazy. That's the stupidest and the worst thing to be asked ever. But it goes back to, I get it, because, you know, everybody goes SAS and Army. Oh, you're killing machines. You're this. No, we're not.
No.
You're being what we are. We're absolutely humanitarians beyond belief. Ugh. We're out there putting our life on, sacrificing everything to save people's lives. People that are not related to us, we don't know anything about, but people who are suffering. And that's what the regiment is all about. It's about changing things for the better. Don't get me wrong, we know how to look after ourselves. We know how to put a, you know, fight fire with fire. That's always our last resort. That's exactly what we know. Exactly what everybody's image is. There's two things I could say to you or to anybody else. Go, right, what's your image of an SAS soldier? And everybody thinks 6'6", V-shape, a big, you know, killing machine. I could take you to a room and I'll go, right, in that room is 10 people. 5 are SAS, 5 are not. And I guarantee you get it wrong. It's what, literally, it's about that. It's about using this, not this. If you're 6'6" and stand out like Mr. sort of, I'm too beautiful, don't touch me. I mean, you're already drawing attention to yourself for a start. You're not good to us because you're unoperational.
Yeah.
You know, it's about what you do up here. And
for someone who finished school at such a young age, you are so intelligent.
Yeah. It's the university of life, that old cliche, it really is. And, you know, I'll back that up with everything. There's no better education than actually getting out there, meeting people and travel.
Hmm.
You know, my daughter, I'll give you an example of that. My daughter was 2.5 years into a 5-year university course to be a vet. She was miserable as sin. She was not happy. Although she loved the animals, she just did not like it.
Mm.
So I went, right, with me. I took her out and I took her to Baghdad.
What?
You know, in 2008, when it was still cheeky. And I got her trained in airport security, drug and explosive dog trained, HR trained, and there was something else. Anyway, and you know what? She grew up. She became a woman, not too early, and she became educated. She could smell bullshit a mile away now. She ran a business for me. She ran a multi-million pound business at some stage, and it was the best thing I ever did. And she was happier, and she's streetwise, she's smart. But again, going back to, it's about, you know, it's, so what I think I'm trying to say is travel and the life I live give me the, I'm not academic, I'm far from it. I still can't add two numbers together. But we have calculators, so I'll just ask somebody who can. It's simple. That's why I think that was a toy. Well, I'll ask somebody else. You know, so yeah. But yeah, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot. Sometimes, as my books are the hard way, I've certainly learned the hard way. I had to be punched in the face a couple of times to say, yeah, that does it.
Yeah.
You're right.
You are really like, don't push the red button. You're like, let's push the red button.
Yeah. We were in a nuclear power station in Libya one time, and my mate goes, don't touch any of them buttons. And I went, what, that one?
And what happened? It didn't do anything.
It was actually a power station. I think it fired off about 4 generators. That probably did a lot of damage.
I also am laughing in my head at how, like, some dads would be like, here, go to Europe. Go on a, you know, obviously not at the moment, but, you know, my cousins are very privileged and they get to go to Europe and on their gap years and whatever. And it's like, I cannot imagine them going to Baghdad and doing
I took two of them. I took them to Baghdad first. So they stayed in Iraq from 2008 till about 2011. And then I took them to Haiti after the earthquake.
Oh, that's incredible. And what did you do in Haiti?
It was after the earthquake. I don't know if you remember it, 2010.
Yep.
250,000 people died. So I went out there to do, I was a partner in a business at the time, and went out there, long story short, to donate a bunch of porta cabins, flat packs that we could build into an hospital in literally 7 days because they needed a hospital. So I went out there to do that, build and donate an hospital. And right after the earthquake, 10 days after the earthquake, didn't quite work out that way because it was in such a mess and it was all messed up out there. I ended up building a school, and I did build an hospital in the end, but that was a bit later on. But I ended up building a school and a small clinic for abused women, and a school for homeless kids. With Sean Penn, believe it or not.
That is also amazing. And you ended up working for Sean, right?
Not for him. We did a couple of things together. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you were. I must have.
No. You know, people always thought I was a bodyguard for Sean. I was never a bodyguard for Sean. I was a mate of Sean. Sean doesn't have a bodyguard, but if he's gone anywhere that's a little bit unsavoury, he might give me a call and say, hey, have you got any contacts here or blah, blah, blah. So I'd help him out that way. But Sean, he doesn't need a bodyguard. He's smart, switched on. He can handle himself. But he's a friend. I met him as a friend when I was doing bodyguarding. And we stayed friends and we're still friends now. And, you know, he came into Haiti just roughly the same time as me. I was there donating and I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. And there I was amongst all the debris, looked out one day and then, hey, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? And we went on from, yeah. So the donation, I went over there initially to donate and build a school, build an hospital, was turning into an absolute nightmare drama. And Sean appeared and he goes, well, I'll take it. And we built a school where thousands and thousands of kids went through it. It was brilliant. It was well, well used. He did a great job.
That is, I have no words for you. I think, you know, I think a lot of people listening will be like, this is putting my life in perspective. And also just the fact that you're like my mate, Sean Penn, is also quite incredible. I'm just, I know, I'm sitting here fangirling almost. It's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, I'm just fortunate to go that direction in terms of work and meet these type of people.
Yeah. I mean, so let's talk about the bodyguard stuff, because I know everybody loves talking to you about the bodyguard stuff, particularly, you know, Brad and Angelina. But I'm actually really curious. You were a bodyguard for Russell Crowe, right?
Yeah.
So what did that involve? Because I know with Brad and Angelina, that was very strategic. And I'll kind of explain what you told me was that you were quite strategic in getting the kids to school and you had to kind of choose different ways every day to get them to school so that there was no threat of kidnap. But with Russell, I mean, he's a down-to-earth Aussie. What does that involve?
The thing with the Brad and Angelina was I was like full-time as the head of security, which with Russell, if he was coming into the UK, going for a period of time, week, 2 weeks, whatever it was, then I'd some of the times I'd work with him. And so what that involved is, it does involve, you know, keeping him out of danger, because you always get some overzealous fans who want to do ridiculous things. But if I'm honest, it's probably more keeping Russell away from fighting everybody else. But he can look after himself. I mean, he's a big old lad, you know what I mean? And he's a tough old dude.
And I'm sure he would really love you saying that. He would so get a kick out of it.
The last thing you want is, you know, he's in public eye, he's in... His public image being damaged because some idiot tries to jump on him, you know, and then Russell will probably knock him out anyway, but then you've got this idiot. So I'm there to stop that, be that buffer to make sure that nobody does, you know, destroy his public image.
Of course.
You know, he's got enough. So I'm looking, he's got his head full of, as he does, you know, his work and charity, because he does a lot of charity and all that stuff. Yeah, he is. And so they need to be able to work on that. And then anything around the periphery of that, that's my responsibility. Mm. Make sure he gets from A to B. Make sure he's in the right gear. He's got his right stuff. No one's going to bother him. So that's what it's really about. It's kind of a low-level threat, if you like. But there's always a threat. I mean, you've only got to think back to every celebrity has a love and hate person follows them, without a doubt. Some lunatic. You look at John Lennon.
Yeah.
You know, you're the guy that fell in love with him and then just decided one day he's going to kill him, and he did. So
that is scary.
Without getting dramatic, you know, few and far between. But so you're there to sort of monitor what's going on around him so he can do what he needs to do, because they are busy people. I tell you, I mean, they bang out 16 hours a day most days. And then on top of that, I've got 2 hours after they go to bed, because I've then got to go and do reconnaissance for the next day, check out this, make sure that's ready, to make sure the vehicles are done, make sure that's done. It's hard work. But it was pleasurable, you know, he was down to earth. Well, anyway, it was a blow.
And that's one thing that I wanted to talk to you about, was that you've told me before that being a bodyguard is just a job to you. This is your job. This is, you're hired as somebody who looks after everybody. But everybody else, you know, who looks at you goes, oh my God, he like worked with Brangelina and Russell Crowe and, you know, Sean, your friends with Sean Penn. Like, that's out of anybody's realm of thinking. So how is it to you just a job?
Well, because that's what it was. I needed to get paid. I needed a job. I could quite easily have, I don't know, been working in a coal mine or whatever it was. I just fortunate enough to go that way. And it was just a job. I don't look at them as celebrities. They're a person. they're my client and I need to, what's my responsibility? That's what it is. Mm. I'm not bothered about, you know, who they really are, other than being a real person, a nice person. That's important to me, you know. So I never got fazed by any of that. It doesn't matter who it was, what, you know. So that's exactly how I looked at it. Okay, he's got a job to do. What's my job? My job is security, is well-being, is person, the persona being protected. That's what I have to deal with. It doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter, you know, whether an A-list celebrity or politician or a whatever, or, you know.
Without naming names, because I know that you can't really, without naming names, was there a situation that was a really hairy, scary situation that you thought you weren't going to get out of or get them out of?
Security in the bodyguard world.
Yeah.
No, really. I mean, I think we ended up in, I never felt we were ever not going to get out of somewhere. I mean, you always have to have your finger on the pulse, because you got to remember, when nothing, 99% of the time, nothing's going to happen, but it's only going to take 1% for one thing to happen. And you know what I mean? There's no going back on it. You know, suddenly all of a sudden out of the crowd leaps forward a knife and sticks it in your client's face. You should have been there to stop that. And by me doing my job, give them that, you know, I'm sure there's times when everybody a bodyguard thinks, well, why have I got a bodyguard? Nothing ever happens. Well, nothing ever happens because I'm on top of my game.
Yeah.
I'm making sure I'm going this way. I'm making sure that this happens. I'm making sure that that happens, you know. And for anybody doing anything bad, they only have to get lucky once. I have to be lucky every single day because I don't know when anything's going to happen. If you're going to do something, you know when it's going to happen, but I don't know. Mm. And if you're looking to a crowd amount of people, how the hell do you judge who's going to be good or bad? So by using my knowledge and experience, it's making sure that I'm always going to be one step ahead. I'm making sure that they're not leading into the crowd. I'm making sure that they're close enough to me to be able to see everything. I'm looking through the crowd of hundreds of people and who ain't smiling. Well, why ain't smiling when everybody else is? That's the person I'm a little bit concerned about. Because when people are going to do bad things, their demeanor changes, you know? Why would somebody be there be all smiling, happy when they're about to attack somebody? You don't. You might think you are, but you don't.
So when you meet people for the first time, so say, for instance, this is the first time you and I are meeting face-to-face, and so if you looked at me, and what would you profile me straight away? He just smiled. But would... I'm scared to ask now. I don't even know why I asked that. But I'm just curious. Like, would you look at me and go, oh, like, not a threat? Or actually, am I digging myself in a hole?
People's introduction is their energy and the way they act. You know, if somebody's in front of you with a face like thunder and looking through you like you're not really there, you're like a miserable person, blah, 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 you know. Yeah, I mean, you kind of profile. You do it automatically, don't
yeah.
you? You can generally... I mean, I can see you're a fun, bubbly sort of person. You have a laugh. You know, I can tell that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a bad day. We all do. Well, but, yep. And you can see when someone has a bad day. I tell you what I love doing. You probably do. Most people do as well. I love sitting having a coffee outside on the streets and not judging people, watching people. I love it. You can. They go, right. They're married. They're having an affair. That's going. This is happening. That's happening. You can see it.
I want to know one thing you've never told anyone in an interview.
I've never told anybody an interview. This would get out of hand.
This is why I'm asking.
I think I'll probably come across... people say I come across very aggressive sometimes and I'm very... But I'm actually a very sort of soft person. You know, for I'd rather listen to love songs than AC/DC, although I like when I'm trained like AC/DC. But I'm a very...
Love songs?
Yeah, love songs and emotional stuff. I am, that's me. You know, my mistake was, if people knew what you're really like.
That is actually like the best piece of information I've ever heard.
I sit here every night and, you know, like, I know like the younger lads, they'll be playing all the latest hip hop and da-da-da-da, which I'm like, I'm probably like my dad going, what's this, Robin? I'll sit here and put on the Benedictine Monks and just listen to that echoing through the, it just, you know. So, I'm not as aggressive. People go, why are you so aggressive? I'm going, I'm not aggressive. My wife says this to me, go, the way you just spoke to that guy, why are you so aggressive? I go, I'm not aggressive. I'm trying to be aggressive. Do you want to see aggression? She's like, oh, no. I'm not like that at all. I'm actually pretty emotional and laid back type of guy.
For the humanitarian work that you do, and I think there will be so many people who don't even realise what you have done beyond SAS Australia, beyond SAS the UK. And I think that I wholeheartedly believe that you're an absolute marshmallow. Absolute marshmallow.
Until I don't need to be.
Yeah. Except that if I ever needed a bodyguard, I know who I'm calling to profile all the creeps around me. So my last question I love to close out my chats with is, what piece of advice do you have for your younger self, knowing what you know now?
Just don't be afraid to make a mistake and fail. You know, because we're all, and you've heard the saying so many times when people go, I knew that. But then don't ever say that. Don't be afraid to say it and get something wrong. It's better to make a stupid mistake or ask a stupid question than to make a stupid mistake. Mm. So don't be afraid to you know, push your boundaries and be knocked back. Because we all, that's why we don't push ourselves, because we're too scared. And we become this society where, you know, schools now, there's no winners, there's no losers. Everybody gets a medal. That's not good. Mm. That's not good. So push yourself and don't be afraid to, because that's how we become who we are. We learn from our mistakes.
Yeah.
Then what I would say on the other end of that coin is if that's a mistake. If you're repeating the same mistake, then that is a problem.
Mm.
So that in your mind, you know, don't be afraid to make a mistake. But if you're making the same mistake over and over again, then, you know, that's a problem. You've got a little. But so don't be afraid to make a mistake, but bounce back up and keep going forward.
And then what's your motto again? Always a little bit further.
Always a little further.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for chatting to me today. I honestly, this has been an absolute delight, and you are such a gem of a human. And thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure, and look forward to seeing you.
Well, that was such a good chat. Make sure you check out Billy on SAS Australia, streaming now on Channel 7 and 7play. On the next episode of The Good Chat, I chat to actor Hugh Sheridan, who is about to star in Back to the Rafters on Amazon Prime and is also starring in 5 Bedrooms on Paramount Plus. You're not going to want to miss it. And if you like this chat, you can rate, follow and review and follow me on Instagram at @AnitaAnnabelle_ and @TheGoodChatPod. See you next week.